Stand by. Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
We kick things off with talented Canadian musician David Miles talking about his collaborations with hip-hop artist Classified, as well as about his latest album, In the Nighttime, and recent single, One in a Million. We then chat with social media expert Patrick Charles about why it's so hard for artists to break a million in sales these days. Singer-songwriter Luke Nicholson pops by talking about his new CD, Frantic City, and we wrap things up with Dr. Louise Ackie helping you pet-proof your home so that your animals stay safe.
Capture your need for sound.
We're happy to welcome back to the show Canadian singer-songwriter David Miles, who's had an amazing ride the last year or so, winning a Juno Award for Rap Recording of the Year for his collaboration with hip-hop artist Classified on their hit song Inner Ninja. He's also picked up numerous awards on his own, like Songwriter of the Year at the East Coast Music Awards, and continues to promote his latest album, In the Nighttime. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So, Dave, the last time you were on, you were sort of in the midst of the crazy success of Inner Ninja. So I wanted to ask you, I guess, like a follow-up to all of that. Were you able to actually enjoy the success of the song, or were you really too busy? And do you think that song is going to follow you for the rest of your career?
You know what? I totally did enjoy it. It was a really fun. I mean, the amazing thing about that song is that it just never seemed to stop. Like, just when we thought it was starting to die down, one thing would happen with a single, it was going crazy on radio, and then all of a sudden, you know, the video started going really viral, and then all of a sudden, just recently, this month, it's in the new Bill Murray movie. It was on the trailer for the new Bill Murray movie. So, like, there's always these moments that continue with that song. So Luke and I, Classified and I, always find ourselves kind of laughing, getting together, and making sure that we take time to actually enjoy the fact that the song has done so well. Because we have such a good time working together, and we had such a good time making that song, that there were like moments after the Junos that we would sit down and go, "Man, this has been an amazing experience," you know. And then, but we were lucky. Yeah, no, we definitely did. It was super busy, but there were always moments where you get to sit back and go, "This is a pretty special thing." When you make a song in a studio in isolation, you kind of think that it's something special. And then you let it out, and all of a sudden everybody responds. It's an amazing feeling.
You mentioned obviously how much fun you have working with Classified. I wanted to ask you, you know, further to that, what has working with him actually, you know, or how has working with him added to your sound and the direction of your music?
Oh, it's really affected a lot. You know, it's funny because it hasn't affected the way I write songs or how I sing. He's always been encouraging me to keep that kind of separate. I work in isolation when I work on the songs, and I kind of bring them to him. But I find what's really interesting is that it's really changed my perspective of momentum in a song and how much energy. Like, his whole way of looking at a song is really about energy and momentum. Whereas for me, it was all about harmony and kind of the technical details of music. He looks at kind of the big stuff. And that's been a really kind of revolutionary way for me to look at music. It's helped me because I grew up in the, you know, in doing Royal Conservatory and knowing all the theory of music. I mean, sometimes when you know all that stuff, you kind of look a little too close. It's important to kind of step back and go, okay, how does this song make me feel? How does the chorus make me feel? Where is the energy of the song? Where does it lose energy? And that's how Class listens to stuff. And so it's definitely made me think about that stuff differently. And we still work together all the time. Once or twice a week, we're in the studio together still right now. So
that's amazing. Because I actually wanted to ask you if you think you'll continue to work with him down the line. Because it almost feels like you guys are like Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen.
Well, I thought that's nice. You know what? I hope that's the case. You know what? It's such an interesting thing because we didn't expect it. I don't think anybody else expected it to work so well. I mean, one thing is that we get along really well. We like working together. We have a blast. So that makes a big difference. It's no fun working with someone, no matter how well it works, if you don't get along. But we've become super good friends. And we recognize that I think we each bring something to each other's music. And Inner Ninja was one of the, you know, was part of an ongoing kind of collaboration. It just, we had a sense when we started working that we were on to something. And then that song kind of went, wow, look, maybe we were. And so we've just continued on and tried to really hone in on what we're doing and continue to take risks. That's the other thing, is that we're both kind of, especially after Inner Ninja, that was a risk, you know, like we were kind of going, is this going to work? this could be seen as pretty ridiculous. And then we put it out and it did. And so I think it gives you a big confidence, right? You got to go, okay, well, you know what? You got to trust your instinct. And together we generally, even though we come at things differently, we, at the end of the day, we agree what sounds right, what sounds good. And so that's, we're just continuing on all the time. He's producing a new record for me, which I haven't even started talking about to people. You're the first to know. And I'm working on some tracks for his new record too. So
I want to say, as like an outsider who's sort of watching what's coming out of Halifax, I almost feel like you guys have your own sound, your own, like, I don't know if you remember back in the day, but I remember that, like, when Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis were sort of working out of Minneapolis, there was that Minneapolis sound, you know, that everybody sort of knew, like with Prince and all that sort of stuff. And now I feel like you guys are doing that, especially because I recently spoke to Rhea May, and I almost feel like she's like the female version of you in a way, especially with her new track, Close Off. Do you think the three of you might collaborate? And how do you feel about the Halifax scene in general?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? I think we will. I have already helped, you know, a little bit on some songs and stuff. Just kind of popped into the studio when they've been working and given my two cents, which has been really cool. Rhea's great. That Close Off song is a seriously great track. You know what? I love the Halifax scene because of that. I think because it's collaborative, you know? I mean, people are, especially, like, I mean, I think that both Clash and I really are people who love to work with different people who work in different genres. And I think that that's where the strength of Halifax is going to come, because it's not a huge city, but there's lots of really talented people. And once you start to combine, you know, you make these kind of interesting combinations, you get some pretty cool stuff. You know, the Rhea Clash thing is a great example of that. It's really neat, and there's more to come. So yeah, no, I mean, all the time. I think that that's kind of where Klaus and I are at too, is working as kind of a production team sometimes on this stuff, where I kind of look at some of the song stuff and he's looking at the actual beats and the production track.
Joining us on the show is Juno Award-winning artist David Miles. Make sure to check out his website, davidmiles.com. Your latest album, Dave, In the Nighttime, is actually a 2-disc CD. Can you explain the reasoning behind you coming out with 2 CDs in a landscape that I feel, and I think other people would agree, is sort of like based off strong singles at the moment as opposed to albums?
Yeah, it totally is. It is. You know, it was an interesting decision. But you know what? At the same time, I have a large part of the work I do is in theaters. I play a lot of theaters, and I play acoustic music. It's quite different from what I do with class, and that's a very big part of what I do, and it's something that I think a lot of people really enjoy, and it's an important part. And so I really didn't, I was in the midst of making a roots record, you know, more of a singer-songwriter record, and that I was really happy with. But every time I was home from the studio, I was going out to class's studio, and we were working on other stuff, and I kind of got to this point where I had two projects that I was working on at the same time, and I went, I like both of these, and both of them are reflective of who I am. And I just didn't really feel like I wanted to get into marketing them differently. I just felt like, you know, even though they're different musically, the point is that they're both very much me. They're songs that I really enjoy. I like the way both approaches sound. And I felt like it was important for me, for both, you know, for the fans that were into my singer-songwriter acoustic stuff, to understand that I have this other side of me, and vice versa. So I just decided, you know what, let's put the whole thing out together. And because that's how I define myself, you know what I mean? Like that is part of it. And Klaus was a big part of that too. You know, he kind of said, listen, man, you do this, you do your roots thing, your singer-songwriter thing, and it's cool. So don't try to hide it. Like, just get behind it and do both things. And I kind of, that's what I decided to do. And it was the right move. It was the right move. At the end of the day, I kind of went, you know what, it makes for a more interesting record, because you get a lot to listen to, and different sounds and different moods. So it did work for me, for sure.
Your latest single is called One in a Million. What's the theme behind the track, and did the track come easily to you to write?
Well, you know what? That's interesting, because it really does vary. Like, some tracks are easy, some tracks are difficult. That track came quickly. It came really quickly. It was late in the game. We were pretty close to being done the record. That was when I was working with Klaus. We were almost done the EP, and I love writing love songs. I mean, it's a really big part of what I do. I've always been into the crooner thing, you know, into Sinatra and Chet Baker and all those guys and all the classic soul guys. And I just thought, you know what, I wanted one more ballad. And so that's what I did. I wrote a love song for my wife, and it's kind of about us meeting and that feeling when you meet someone that, you know, it's special. And so it came quick, and then we made the track really quick. The whole thing came together, and there was something about it that we didn't want to mess with it. You know, it was one of those things that I wrote relatively quickly. We produced the track quickly, and at the end of the day, we went, no, this sounds right. This is exactly how it should sound.
What's coming up next for you in the following months, Dave?
I got a Christmas record coming out.
Look at you. That's amazing.
That's right. Yeah, I know. It's pretty exciting. I know, from rap recording of the year to a Christmas record.
That's awesome.
I like to mix it up. You know what? It's something I've thought about doing. I do a tour in New Brunswick every year where I play free shows and raise money and food donations for the food banks in New Brunswick. And I've done this for the last 4 or 5 years, and it's grown each year quite significantly. And each year I learned a couple more Christmas songs, and I thought, you know what, I was getting into them. I actually really started to enjoy playing them. And I just thought, you know what, let's do it. I really wanted to write a few songs. So I waited until I had the right songs, and we actually recorded it last Christmas.
Okay.
So it was the perfect time to record at Joel Plaskett Studio here in Halifax. And, it was a really, really great experience. It came out really cool. It's pretty old school sounding. It's a real vintage kind of Christmas record, but it came out really nice. So that's what we're basically in the end. Come end of November, I go on the road, and I'm touring Ontario and Quebec, and I'll do my food bank tour in New Brunswick, and so it's pretty cool.
That is fantastic. Well, can we have you back on the show again to talk about it? Maybe a little bit later.
Let's do that for sure.
Awesome, David. Thank you so much for your time, and all the best.
Thank you.
That's Juno Award-winning Canadian artist David Miles. Again, check out his website, davidmiles.com.
Hi, this is David Miles. You're hanging out on the Kelly Alexander Show.
I've been thinking about when I first met you, when I came to realize I would never ever forget you, no matter how hard I try. Different people at this point in my life, but this time didn't feel the same. 'Cause you're one in a million, one in a million, one in a million to me. You're one in a million, one in a million, one in a million to me. Talking about where we were from, I looked to the sky, the stars above, but that night there was only one in a million.
lot has been made of the fact that no artist has been able to sell 1 million albums in 2014, for many reasons. The most recent collections that got close to that number, Beyoncé and Lorde's albums, came out in 2013. It looks like the only hope for the industry is Taylor Swift. Why is that? To talk about all of this is our social media expert in our music and technology segment, Patrick Charles. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. So, I noticed in the last couple of weeks, this has been like the big topic, like, oh my God, nobody's, cracked a million. Why is that, do you think?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of stuff going on. I mean, it's only, like you said, Beyoncé and Lorde's albums that came out last year, and they actually didn't even make it to a million, which is crazy. But there's a whole bunch of things. I mean, first of all, I'm going to go out there and say it, and, iTunes is pretty much over.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it works in some instances, but streaming really is taking a big chunk out of it. iTunes is down, I believe, about 14% this year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's down quite a bit. So, streaming really is taking over from people actually buying files, and that's major.
That is definitely major. And is that the whole thing that's behind the drop in sales?
Well, no, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, also, you have to look at, every year they do this with movies and they do it with music, and it's kind of funny. They say the sky is falling because this many records weren't sold or that many movie tickets, but you also have to look at who didn't make an album this year.
Okay.
And there's a lot of people. There's Eminem,
yeah.
Kanye West, Jay-Z, Beyoncé, Rihanna, Drake, Adele. Like, all of these people don't have a record out there, like a new record out this year for
right.
2014. So those are the people that would have had a chance at selling a million potentially, and they don't have anything out.
Do you think, or are you surprised by the fact that the, act du jour, Sam Smith, didn't make the million?
Yeah, I'm actually a little bit surprised, but it still comes down to the songs, though, and how much they resonate with people. That's the other thing. It's too easy to say that, like, oh, I'm surprised that didn't sell a million. But I think that Rolling in the Deep and the songs on Adele's records resonated with people more than, name three Sam Smith tracks that you really love,
Right.
And I don't think that they just resonated as much as they possibly could have. So I'll say the material wasn't there, as great as his voice is.
And with regards to John Legend, like his album that song, was just the song. Like he didn't really, because I think on the station I work for, I think we did play his follow-up for like a hot minute. And I don't even remember if we did. Like now I'm like, did we really play it? I don't know.
Yeah, the big thing is singles. I mean, a lot of singles sold over a million copies. That's kind of an interesting thing. It's like we're the 1950s again, right? Where you just have that hot song. It's not a question of people wanting to sit down and listen to a whole album as much as it is they want to hear that one song. That All of Me song has been everywhere for I don't know how long.
Mm-hmm.
Please make it stop.
Yeah, I know. Trust me. I love him. I think he's an excellent artist. And I saw him in concert this year, earlier this year. And yeah,
right,
I can't deal with it because it's like the wedding song of 2014, right? Like it's just
exactly.
It's a lot going on. But I do have to say I am kind of surprised about the Sam Smith just because you're right. Like, I guess it didn't resonate as much as Adele, but I kind of view him as like the male Adele. Maybe it's just because they're British. Like, I don't know. But I figured like
yeah.
He would have done it.
And I always say Sam Smith is like a slightly less masculine Adele.
Right. Exactly. Very good. Especially because, on the station that I work for, we did play him quite a bit, and we are
sure.
Continuing to play him quite a bit. So I guess I was like, oh, this must be everywhere. But obviously, like you said, it probably didn't strike a chord as much. I mean, her voice is so amazing and out of this world. Not that his isn't. I like him quite a bit, but it's just different.
Yeah, I just think it comes down to the songs, though. I just think that, Adele, there was a lot more of a sort of a groundswell behind her than there is with Sam Smith. It's just been a lot more with him, like, oh, he's really great, and that's it. But it doesn't really move people the same way.
Now, with regards to the 1 million album situation, do you think this will turn around? Like, do you think we'll ever have more albums? Like, or will there be even the Beyoncés of the world that will pull it off?
I don't think so, because I think that... another thing that people don't look at is there's so many things pulling away from that. Like even Beyoncé, she released that surprise album last year, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the thing is, it came with like 13 videos for 13 songs or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So I think that the visual element now, especially with people who are, just starting to buy music like teenagers, I think that for them, if there's not something to look at, it's not as big of a deal. Like, I mean, we used to, like, you know, when you were a kid, you'd hear about an album you wanted to get, and you would get it, and you would stare at the cover, you know,
right,
just at the crazy art, and you'd, like, look at that, and it was still a big enough deal for you. Whereas now, I mean, everybody looks at YouTube views, right? Everybody goes like, oh, that song is great. It's got 20 million YouTube views. Mm-hmm. Like, that makes the song great. How many times people have looked at it? Right. So it says a lot about the way we think about music and the way we look at music, you know. There's another thing too. I mean, you know, people talk about, you know, this should have sold a million, that should have sold a million, but there's also the marketing behind it.
Mm-hmm.
They used to spend a lot more money on albums, on big records.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, look, the Beyonce thing, everybody's saying that, wow, it's like new marketing for this century. She surprised released it. Nobody knew she was even working on it, and it sold close to a million copies. But here's the thing. How much would it have sold if they did market it?
Right.
Because it just sort of came out, and then you only heard about it through, like, word of mouth and social media, and then that was it.
Yep.
I mean, I don't even know what the cover looks like, to be honest. You know, I didn't see it on the side of a bus. I didn't see it in a magazine. So it's not marketed the same way they used to market albums, like, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that still matters, Patrick?
The marketing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just like in general?
Like,
yeah.
Well, the traditional marketing, like on the bus, you know what I mean? Like on a bus stop, like billboards.
I think it does, because I think it works in a way that it doesn't work the way people think it does. I think people think it works because you see a picture of Beyonce, so you walk like a zombie to the, you know, to HMV and go buy her album. But I don't think it's that. I think that it convinces you that somebody is more important than they actually are.
Right.
When you see that stuff. So I think that when you see, you know, Sam Smith on the side of the bus, you believe that he's a bigger deal than he actually is.
Oh, right. Okay.
So I think that has a lot to do with it. And I think that, you know, it sort of makes people think twice if they haven't seen you anywhere. Mm-hmm. It seems like you're just not that important.
This next question actually is sort of thought-provoking to me, because, you know, does it say anything about, or does it say something about the music, the fact, or the quality of the music, the fact that, you know, people aren't selling a million? But, I mean, you know, a lot of, and I know, you know, from the business that you and I are in, like, a lot of people poo-poo top 40, right? They're like, oh, it's the computer music. But then look at U2's album, didn't, you know, I don't think it's going to do the 1 million, just even the way it was dropped.
No, definitely not. And it's very interesting. I mean, yeah, I don't think it has to do with the quality of the music, but I think it has a lot to do with the perception of the music.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's just more accessible now, and people are used to listening to stuff on YouTube. And yeah, that's satisfying for a lot of people.
About the U2 thing, again, like, I know you and I talked extensively about it, so I don't really want to go back to how it was dropped or whatever, but do you think even, you know, because, like, 3 years ago, right, in 2011, I think that's when they did the 360 tour. Like, that was,
yeah,
you know, it was so big. And the perception, like you said, was massive. And, like, you know, they're coming to your town and it's going to be, like, you know, here in Montreal where we live, you know, it was shut down for, like, basically 2 days, like a section of the city while they did this concert. But the perception of them now, just with what happened with Apple, I almost feel like, I still think they're cool, but I feel like a lot of people don't.
Well, I think that this stunt hurt them in the sense that people who didn't care about them before now actively dislike them.
Oh, okay. Wow. Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah. You weren't thinking about them until they put them in your iTunes, and now you actually don't like them.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's weird because, like, I really do feel like, just like you said, the way that I think it hurt them. I really do. Even though I think it's ridiculous and I think people should be happy they got a free U2 album, I feel like people
Absolutely.
Are like, I can't believe you did this to us. Like, it's like yeah. some grave injustice.
It's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. And I actually
really
went on the
ridiculous.
Air a couple of weeks ago, you know, and talked about it because I was like, really, get over yourselves. Like, really,
yeah.
like, just delete the album if it hurts. You know, there's so many other things that get shoved down our throat, like these, you know, pop-up ads and cookies in our computer. And I'm like, you actually got quality music and you're mad about it? Like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, it's really crazy, but that's the way it is.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how people look at these things.
Now, is there a bright spot in the fact that, you know, a million albums is probably not going to happen very often again?
Actually, yeah, I'd say definitely, because here's an interesting thing. Something that they don't take into account is that there have been a lot of people selling through non-traditional ways. I mean, like Bandcamp, you know, Bandcamp, you can, if you're an independent artist, you can put your album on there and sell it directly to people.
Okay.
You know, and you keep, like, a really high percentage of the money. I think it's like 70 or 80% of the money from the sales. And I think that there are more and more people doing that. I mean, Bandcamp did really well last year. I mean, they actually pay out millions of dollars every year in royalties to people who have their albums posted on their site. And Yeah, I think that a lot of it has to do with that. I mean, the fact that you can distribute stuff by yourself, just overall, I think the industry is shifting away from the major labels, so you don't have these big solid numbers anymore. But I think, you know, there's always going to be those people who can sell quite a few copies of things on their own.
This is all crazy, right? It's just, it's so crazy, the whole thing.
It is, completely.
Thank you so much for this, though, because I think, like I said, this has been a hot button issue for the last couple of weeks, so I'm glad we got to delve into it a bit further.
Yeah, definitely.
That is our social media expert. And again, we talk about music and technology with Patrick Charles. You can learn more about him, of course, on our website, KellyAlexanderShow.com, and follow him on Twitter at GetPatrick.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
We're happy to welcome Canadian singer-songwriter Luke Nicholson to the Kelly Alexander Show, talking about his rising music career and being an artist in Canada. Luke, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kelly. It's nice to be here this morning.
So I wanted to ask you, just for people who may be sort of only learning about you, because we do have people that are listening actually overseas in Japan and Australia, how did you get your start in music?
Well, that's a long question. I know it's a short interview, but the easy one is to say is that I had parents who put myself and my siblings in music at a very, very young age. Officially getting into music is just kind of, I guess that bug was started and I just had it in me. And it was kind of fostered through, you know, high school band and everything else. There's always music in my life. And then after going to university, it was just kind of obvious that the only thing I really wanted to do was, you know, be in the music industry in some way, either as a songwriter, a singer, you know, even on the other end of it. Like, I've just been around it my entire, you know, early adulthood and into adulthood. So it's been there forever.
What musical instruments do you gravitate towards?
Generally, whatever's portable lately. Okay. I love the piano. I play the piano. I have a baby grand at home, but it's not always with me. But so I would say guitar more than anything is the one that I'm usually finding myself grabbing, just because it's something that I seem to always have. But I play a lot of instruments, but that is definitely one where I do my songwriting on. If I have trouble finding a bridge or a chord, sometimes I stop with whatever instrument I'm using and I switch to another one to see if, you know, something opens up artistically. But generally, I would say guitar is the one I'm... This is definitely the record I have coming down the pipe, all are written on the guitar, and they're all guitar songs, for sure.
Speaking of your writing process, do you have sort of a formula? I don't mean to put it in such like a technical word, but do you have a formula, or does the things constantly change about how you actually write and record your songs?
They're constantly changing. I wish I had a formula. it's more of a flow. It's to be honest, some songs I write are strictly lyrical. The lyrics come first, and then I struggle finding a melody or a harmony or structure for the song. Other songs, it's a rhythm that I have in my head, you know, whether it be 3-4 time or just something where, and then I kind of fill in the words afterwards. And then other times you get that magical moment where you literally sit down with a guitar, piano, or whatever, and you strum something, and it just pours out of you, almost like it comes from somewhere else. My process usually is I write the song in about an hour, and it's done, and then it takes weeks, if not months, of really examining the flow and the progressions and the lyrics. Almost never do I just write a song, and it's done. Like, you think it's done, and maybe when I was a kid and I was starting out, I thought it was done, but when you really get into this business and you see what's out there and what's been written, you realize that it's a lot of work and you really have to be, I don't want to say analytical because you still want it to be a creative process, but you really do examine, you know, where the push comes from the bridge and, you know, where the build happens before the chorus and you examine your lyrics. I mean, you're telling a story, so your lyrics have to make sense. You have to have people connect with what you're talking about as well. So it's a long process.
How would you describe your sound, Luke? And do you find that it's changing as you evolve and mature as an artist?
Yeah, definitely. I can say that the record I put out, my last record, Mad Love, was something that I kind of rediscovered my love of piano, and they were piano songs. And I also had just gotten married, and you're living in that space of love. And so they were all very upbeat and happy songs. And, you know, and this next record is called Frantic City, and it's kind of the whole, you know, you've been married for a couple of years and you now have a kid and you're a touring musician and, you know, you're away from home. And it's just, you know, everything I write about is personal, and I can't help but, you know, if I could explain to you that when I started writing this record, what was going on, you know, having a young child at home and having to, you know, that extra money that needs to come into the house and just all these things, you know, and then you're away and it's just everything's happening so frantically. And that's kind of hence the record title, Frantic City. So my music has changed as far as my emotions and my experiences have changed. But as the actual sound, I still am, like, if you pick up my record from this record to the last record, you still know it's me. You still know this, hey, this is Liz Nicholson. That's all very true. But the emotions have definitely changed for sure. And so is the nature of the songs.
Now that you are a father, do you find you look at your career differently? Like, has it changed your perspective and even how you go about things now from a business side?
Yeah, absolutely. You're not providing for yourself anymore. You know, when I was, you know, a young musician, you could go on no sleep and you could, you know, just have enough to pay for gas to get from point A to point B to play your next show. But now it's about, you know, the bottom end, which is you need to have a career and you need to have incomes coming in. And I found in the last 2 years, I've branched myself out. So I'm doing more things like, you know, songwriting and co-writing and, you know, trying to do more things, not just the touring and not just the actual songwriting, but just revenue streams, I guess you'd call them. Because at the end of the day, it really is a business. And, you know, you need this. You need all of these things working for you. That's the reality of today's artists. You don't just write a song and you're overnight, you make lots of money. You need to have everything working for you at the same time.
Do you find touring is also different for you now, knowing that you have like a wife and child at home? I'm not sure if they come with you, but is that even changed your perspective of how you navigate yourself across Canada?
Oh, no, it has. It absolutely has. It's for total example, my last record, when it came out, my daughter was about 5 weeks old. And anyone who's ever booked a tour knows that it takes a long time to book one. So, you know, my tour was booked long before we knew we were having a baby. So once the baby came, I had commitments and I had to play these shows, and I did the show and I pushed the record, and then I came home and I haven't toured other than, you know, quick, you know, flights to Europe to play some festivals. I've really laid low the last, you know, 15 months, just working on from home, just writing and recording this next record. And I'm doing, and I basically, not consciously, but I just, my wife and I just sat down and said, you know, I'm going to take it easy and I got to be a stay-at-home dad here. And it's worked great because my wife works days and I work, you know, whatever I want to work. And for this next one, we're planning on having another baby and we're going to try and do the same thing. So, you know, I basically know that from the time she's pregnant, I've got about 9 or 10 months to get my stuff together. So that's where I'm hoping to do the bulk of my touring. And then I'm back and I can kind of just be around and just pick where I need and want to play. So yeah, it's definitely changed for sure.
Joining us on the show is Canadian singer-songwriter Luke Nicholson. You can learn more about him on his website, lukenicholson.ca. Who do you look up to musically, Luke?
Honestly, like the honest answer to that is, because it's so close to home, would be my brother. I've got a musical brother who's doing very well in Canada, and I don't know how many people know, but his name's Royal Wood. And I follow his career a lot. You know, he's a younger brother, so there's that, definitely have that sibling rivalry, but at the same time, there's a mutual respect as far as our songwriting goes. And he's such a businessman and he's so workmanlike with his career. And I've really tried to emulate that. And I bring that into, like I was saying to you before, it really truly is a business. It's not just about, you know, having the song or whatever. It's really crafting yourself as a brand. And I've really tried to emulate that.
And what are your goals for, you know, the next 6 months? Because it's funny, when I started off, I used to ask, you know, what's your next goal for the next like 18 months to 2 years? But I find now that the world is spinning so fast and social media has made everything quicker, I almost have to shorten that time down because everything's just moving. So what do you want to see happen in the next 6 months?
In the next 6 months, I have a new single coming out in September as well. I would love to see that do really, really well. I have a record coming out. My last record's being released in Germany, so I'd love to see that do well. And I want to get, you know, when we get the record finally done, which is being released in January, I want to spend the next 6 months promoting. So when January lands, it's everyone already knows about it and it's pushed. And so the release is good. And I've set myself up with, you know, syncing opportunities and licensing opportunities, because that really is kind of where music is going now for artists. I mean, you have to have your music in film, you have to have it in commercials, and you always have to be pushing your brand and getting your name out there. So I'm hoping that in 6 months when my record launches, everyone knows about it. That's I'm working with a PR company right now, and we're just laying a plan, as they say, just to get everything to drop at the same time.
And before I let you go, Luke, what do you want, you know, fans of yours and music fans that are going to be learning about you to know about you? Like, what sets you apart from other people that are out on the Canadian music scene?
The biggest thing that sets me apart is, I guess, I'm doing both. I mean, there's very few artists out there that are in my, you know, age group and who are trying to do both. I mean, it's a very, you know, lonely place, the road, and it's really lonely when you have a family at home. So, I mean, I bring all that emotion to me when I'm on stage. You can really see it because, you know, the songs that I craft are about what's going on in my life, and it's, you know, about my family and the things I miss, and you can really see that emotion when you're on stage. I guess that would set me apart. Although the people that I've met that do have children, we instantly bond.
I'm sure you do. Luke, thank you so much for your time. It's been really great to speak with you today.
Thank you very much, Kelly.
That's Canadian singer-songwriter Luke Nicholson. Again, make sure to follow him on his website where you can grab all of his social media, lukenicholson.ca.
Hey, it's Luke Nicholson. You're hanging out on the Kelly Alexander Show.
All the lonely boys lying in the hills, thinking of the one got away. Don't you see that all the lonely girls lying in the beds, dreaming of the one who wouldn't stay? Don't you see that all around the world, all the boys and girls trying to find the one? All you need is me. All you need is someone. Just a
We know it's important to baby-proof our homes for our young children, but what about pet-proofing our homes to make sure our beloved pets stay safe and sound? We've asked Dr. Louise Aki to give us some important information on how to keep our pets secure from common hazards lying around the house. Dr. Aki, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm delighted to be back.
So, Dr. Aki, why do you think that we forget to pet-proof our homes? Because, you know, so many people are absolutely in love with their animals that it kind of seems odd that we wouldn't think more about their well-being in the grand scheme.
Well, there are some foods that are perfectly safe for us that we just don't think are dangerous to our pets. And I'm going to give you an example, raisins.
Right.
Raisins and grapes. They have a natural compound that's very dangerous to the kidneys of dogs. So your dog, which will eat raisins or grapes, just like if you feed them, they'll eat them, and they can get kidney failure from raisins or grapes. And so we don't think about it. It's not like, oh, I know better to not let drain cleaner and other toxins around my pets. So we may have our house pet-proofed against poisons that we already recognize that would be poisons to our children. But what about these foods that our children and we can eat perfectly safely but are dangerous to our pets? Raisins are the most common that people don't realize.
Okay. Yeah, I would have never even thought about it. I would have thought raisins not a good idea just because I think anyone can choke on those things. But yeah, I wouldn't have thought that it was actually like physically dangerous with regards to their sort of insides. And I wanted to ask you, you know, is there a bit of a difference pet-proofing your home for a cat versus for a dog?
In the sense that cats can get places where your dogs often can't, which... Mm-hmm. I have Scottish Terriers. They're very short. They don't jump very well.
Right.
So they're unlikely to be able to leap onto kitchen tables, kitchen counters, top of refrigerators. But cats are much more agile in jumping. So you want to be sure that you pet-proof those upper areas. Again, thinking about children who can climb, cats can climb very easily and get into trouble that way. There are other compounds, and I wanted to mention xylitol. One of my friends is a veterinary toxicologist with a new pet poison center out here in Washington State, and she mentioned xylitol, which is what you hear about from your dentist, to help prevent cavities. It's an artificial sweetener, and there's xylitol is in gum. It's in icebreakers. You can buy it in a powder to use in place of sugar in baked goods. But xylitol works in our bodies by blocking the action of our pancreas to sugar. So it's calorie-free, and it does not cause an increase in cavities in our mouth. So we can chew the gum, and instead of sugared gum, which increases cavities, xylitol actually protects your teeth against cavities. So dentists love xylitol. There is no safe ingestion or safe dose of xylitol for pets, especially dogs. And what happens in dogs is the xylitol acts like a sugar, and it drops their blood sugar really, really fast. So it blocks their ability to respond to that, and it causes seizures, and it can also be dangerous and attack their liver as well. So xylitol gum, xylitol mints, you don't want them out on your coffee table or in a mint tray. If you have pets around, or if you have family members who bring their pets over, we want to be very, very careful about that. And you don't think about that because that would be perfectly safe for kids.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, you wouldn't think about that. And I was reading that there are two common painkillers that are actually deadly to cats. So what would they be, and how do you avoid that?
The main painkiller that's deadly to cats is what we would think of as our safest painkiller, and that is Tylenol. The generic name is acetaminophen. So that would be the most dangerous thing, and you want to be sure that you avoid that. There's another medicine, which is an antidepressant, and cats, for some reason, love the capsules. this prescription antidepressant capsules have something in the capsule that the cats are extremely attracted to, and they will open up containers and they will get to them, and it's a toxic dose. So you'll need to be careful to protect your animals from your pills.
Okay, gotcha. Joining us on the show is pharmacist Dr. Louise Ackie, author of the book Why Dogs Eat Chocolate, How Medicines Work and How You Can Take Them Safely. Make sure to check her out on her website, askdrlouise.com. What is the most common substance eaten by pets?
The most dangerous one, the one we get the most calls about from people, from pet poison centers, is chocolate. Ingestion of chocolate. And chocolate comes from beans on a tree, the cacao tree, and the shells of these beans were initially used, they were ground up and added to animal feed. And they found that the feed that had these shells in them ground up, the baby animals started dying unexpectedly. And what they found is a perfectly natural component of chocolate called theobromine is dangerous to animals. It acts like super caffeine, because it gets in their system and their bodies cannot detoxify it, so it rapidly reaches toxic levels. Now, if you have cats, cats are usually very picky eaters as far as chocolate goes, but I know some people whose cats love chocolate, but dogs absolutely cannot leave it alone. So chocolate, a bag of chocolate, a big chocolate bar, a dog will eat the entire thing. And there are stories of people who've lost whole plates of brownies off the table from their dog, bags of chocolate, boxes of chocolate. And the problem is a small dog, and we're talking maybe a 20 to 25-pound dog, a small bag of chocolate chips, Kelly, is a lethal dose for a
wow.
dog that size. Just a small bag, not the big 12-ounce bag, the 6-ounce bag of chocolate. So again, we don't think about that because chocolate is not dangerous to us. It is very dangerous to our dogs. And if you have a cat that loves chocolate, you need to be careful about keeping chocolate away from your cat as well.
I wanted to ask you about, you know, some people are still smoking cigarettes, nicotine, all that kind of stuff. Even cannabis, you know, I'm sure that's laying around in a fair amount of people's homes. Is that dangerous for cats and dogs and other animals to get into?
Yes. As a matter of fact, my dog had ingested some mushrooms, and we had taken her to the emergency vet to save her life, and we managed to do that. And I asked them, what is the most common ingestion that you see with pets? And they said, cannabis.
Wow.
I said, you're kidding. No, in fact, Washington State, once we passed the Medical Marijuana Act, people started actually admitting to the vet what their dog had been eating. Before that, they didn't even want to say it.
Right.
So now that they're actually saying, yes, my dog ate an apple that I used in smoking cannabis, marijuana. My dog ate brownies that had marijuana in them. And so whether it's foods that have the ingredient in it, or whether it's stuff that you have lying around that you use associated with it, you want to protect your dog. You really do, so that they do not have a very negative reaction. And it's very distressing. It's very upsetting to the dog.
Now, when it comes to a dog or a cat ingesting whatever, how do you know if it's important to induce vomiting if it's not happening on their own, and how would you even go about doing that? I'm just assuming, like, they say that humans are supposed to do it if you ingest something. So is it the same for animals?
Well, we used to have people keep bottles of Ipecac in their cupboards in case their child got into something that would necessarily need to be removed by vomiting. We have stopped doing that, because there are some compounds, drain cleaner and other toxic compounds, that burn all the way down, and they'll burn just as much or more on the way back up. So some compounds should not be removed by vomiting, and the same type of thing with animals. However, I recommend that you keep a sealed bottle of hydrogen peroxide at home, because if you are ever in a position where your vet wants you to induce vomiting, and we did with the bagels with raisins. Mm-hmm. My dog ate a whole bag of raisin bagels. And so she suggested that we induce vomiting. And you use hydrogen peroxide, and they describe how much to use, and it works fairly promptly. So keep a bottle of hydrogen peroxide sealed in a place where you can get to easily in case of an ingestion. And a pet poison center is so valuable. There are three major pet poison centers, and you can even call your own poison center. They will often connect you to a pet poison center or help you themselves, because they're expanding their services as well. So there are more pet poison centers available to call on than there ever used to be.
How do you know, Dr. Aki, when whatever has happened is serious enough for you to take your animal to the vet? Because, you know, it's almost like I feel like we do it ourselves as humans. Like, let's say you have a ridiculously bad cold. A lot of us feel like, oh, we're just going to work it out at home. And sometimes that is the answer. But sometimes, you know, you might have XYZ and you really should go to the doctor. So how do you know the difference with the pets? Like, because I just feel like some people will be like, oh, you know, it'll pass through their system, or, you know what I mean? Like, how do you know?
I would recommend doing the same thing that you would do if it was your child, to call your vet and explain the situation. Ask, what should I do? Should I make an appointment? Is it something I can treat at home? I would call my vet.
Okay. And before I let you go, Dr. Aki, what do you want to keep in our heads at the forefront with regards to, you know, making sure our homes are pet proofed?
The two most dangerous things to have around are chocolate in the reach of your pets, especially your dogs, and xylitol. And the other thing is to have a pet poison center number posted nearby or in your phone so that you can call if you do have a pet emergency.
Awesome. Dr. Aki, thank you so much for this. We always appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kelly. It's always a pleasure.
That's pharmacist Dr. Louise Aki, again, author of the book Why Dogs Eat Chocolate, How Medicines Work, and How You Can Take Them Safely. Again, make sure to check out her website, AskDrLouise.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
As always, we appreciate you spending time with us on the show. This week, a big shout out to my guests, David Miles, Patrick Charles, Luke Nicholson, and Dr. Louise Aki. Here is your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Vince Lombardi. The measure of who we are is what we do with what we have. Please make sure to follow us on all of our social media, on Twitter, at K Alexander Show, on Facebook, Kelly Alexander Show, on YouTube, Kelly Alexander Show, and of course, our website, KellyAlexanderShow.com. If you've got any comments or questions, drop me a line, Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have a fantastic week. You and I will chat soon.